Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Dov Weiss on his National Jewish Book Award-winning work, Pious Irreverence, Confronting God in Rabbinic Judaism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mevina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, and Moadim L'Simcha. We have completed the High Holy Days, and so naturally the Jewish calendar launches us immediately into another major festival, Sukkot. This is a time of great joy for Jews, traditionally. We're about to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, which is actually my favorite Jewish holiday, in part because it isn't Yom Kippur. No, in fact, I love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and on its central theme of gratitude, which underlies much of what is best about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Sukkot's the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that's one of the truly ancient ones on our complicated Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, also called Sukkot, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all the festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot is the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, little huts outside the house that we decorate with fruits and vegetables, and in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the week-plus long holiday. It's called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, and it's filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things that we have in our lives. Sukkot's the Jewish Thanksgiving. In fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritan fathers on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths. It was particularly important for our ancestors in the time of the Torah, whose entire lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter, and it was something for which to be truly grateful. The reason Sukkot was so observed was likely because it came at the right time of year in the ancient world. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites were supposed to travel to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in the early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges for farmers who had to walk to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these holidays. Springtime, when Passover occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that eventually results in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop, which must be harvested, but there are many other crops still growing that must be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of Israel. But Sukkot comes in the fall. All the crop yields are complete. The harvest is really in. It's a time of plenty, and it must have been a much easier time to take a week, travel to the capital, and celebrate. Sukkot was when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem, bringing their agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, and enjoying the feasts that they held every night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops they were harvesting. It was a time of great joy and celebration, food and drink and conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot's the time when you're commanded to invite guests into your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of the building. It is open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, The four species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, that symbolize the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of Hachnasat Orchim, welcoming guests. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about a sukkah called A Sukkahle by the oddly named duo of Suki and Ding.
A sukkahle, a kleine, vom Breitalach gemeine, hab ich mir a sukkahle gemacht, badeckte mit da. Bisseles kann sitz ich mir in Sikkele bana bedeckte mit da mit a bisseles kann sitz ich mir in Sikkele bana. Doch die Spalten in die lächterlich sei löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, ich mach mir kidisch. In die lächterlich sei brennen ganz still.
That was the pretty song A Sukkahle for the Holiday of Booths that begins tonight. Sukkot. By the way, in Europe, there were homes built with a room that had a retractable roof so it could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, a sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside. It speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday and to being Jewishly observant that entire homes were designed with a sukkah used just 8 days a year in mind. It's also true that some of us only use our formal dining rooms or living rooms that often, when we have guests over, of course, you know, like on Sukkot. Our guest this morning, Professor Dov Weiss, has explored a fascinating aspect of our relationship to God in history and in traditional Jewish text, just how much we are willing to confront and challenge God. Meet Professor Weiss in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Dov Weiss is professor of Jewish studies at the Department of Religion, University of Illinois, and the author of a fascinating book, Pious Irreverence. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the challenge of irreverence and the importance of it in Jewish thought and in kind of rabbinic.
Sure. Well, in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh itself, we know of many biblical heroes who challenge God, and God seems to welcome such a critique or such a challenge, whether it be from Abraham and Moses, Jeremiah, Habakkuk. And yet, what's interesting is that in the early rabbinic period, and here I'm referring to the second, third, fourth centuries of the Common Era in Palestine, the early rabbis seemed to prohibit the notion of critique or protest against God, and that actually became the dominant position of early Christianity. But what I showed in my book is that in the later rabbinic period, from the 5th to the 7th century, the rabbis began embracing the motif of criticizing God, and they saw it not as an act of irreverence, but actually as an act of love, as an act of connection.
Is that the principal diversion, in your opinion, between the patristic writings and the later developments in Judaism? I mean, obviously there's this issue of Jesus, but I mean in terms of the way that the church thought about things as opposed to the way, say, the Talmud thinks about things?
Yes, I think that's a major difference between the later rabbinic position and the Christian position on the legitimacy or even the importance of being honest and being open with God. And I think this difference just points to a larger difference, a larger theological difference between Judaism as it moved into the medieval and modern period and Christianity. And that is that within the Jewish tradition, at least in the rabbinic tradition, God is conceived of as being a character, someone who has emotions, someone has human-like emotions. And what I've argued in my book quite radically is that in some ways the rabbis have humanized God even more than Christians have, because the rabbis think of God as being someone who is morally imperfect. And the rabbis imagine biblical heroes criticizing God and God conceding that he makes moral mistakes. And I think in that sense, the rabbis, the later rabbis, humanize God in ways that even transcend Christians, the Christian humanization of God. Because the Christians humanize God by seeing God as taking on, you know, the human body of
the human form of Jesus, right?
The human form of Jesus, but it's a perfect human being, as opposed to the rabbis who really think of God as not only someone who gets angry and gets upset, but also someone who makes serious moral mistakes. And God welcomes the challenge and critique from his devotees.
Fascinating. We will continue this great discussion with Dov Weiss when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates services, classes, and events this fall, including our very first Sukkot celebration coming up tonight and through the week. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us tonight at 6:30 for our Sukkot services, or Friday night at 6:30 also for Shabbat evening services, 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Join us for Sukkot or for Shabbat. For Sukkot and Simchat Torah, of course, everyone is welcome. As on Shabbat, we begin with a delightful short Sukkot evening service tonight, followed by a potluck dinner in the sukkah. Come by at 6:30 p.m. Celebrate this beautiful outdoor festival of harvest and joy. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar Bat Mitzvah confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course, Sukkot, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in southern Arizona during its exciting beginning year. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach, Happy Sukkot coming up.
And to you.
We've been talking about kind of what made religions become more kind of, I guess, corporate or structured like businesses and less structured that way. Maybe the greatest countervailing examples are the Catholic Church, highly hierarchical, lots of financial structure, deeply involved, financial interests involved in the process. And then the way that Judaism evolved, which was really not like that at all. After the destruction of the Second Temple, when the Jews were thoroughly dispersed, particularly in, both in Europe and in the Arab lands, even if they weren't Arab yet, North Africa, East, Judaism never developed that central structure, you know, of sort of a pope, Vatican, cardinals, bishops, a whole hierarchy. Why not? And let's look at kind of, are synagogues really businesses or something quite different?
Right. So, I mean, Christians might question the assertion that Jews never had a central authority because of the way the New Testament talks about the Sanhedrin. And I'll leave it to you to explain a little bit later what the Sanhedrin was.
Yeah, well, I mean, just briefly, you know, it was the Supreme Court of Judaism, but it was still, it was actually established more or less by the Romans. It was under Roman authority always. So it was never really an fully independent body, no matter what people said about it. Anyway, go ahead.
And it wasn't at the top of a hierarchy. It really, no. Like, settled...
It settled
disputes in a
disputes.
Way like a court,
yeah.
Or like
very much
we
like
have
a
today
court.
A Beit Din, which is
it was
depends on the community and
yeah.
Isn't very authoritative in any case.
Well, I mean, it could execute people and stuff, but it was a court with capital punishment possibilities, but it wasn't there to extract funds. It wasn't there to build a big business. It was there to solve large problems.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about Roman times for a minute, because that's when Christianity as we know it today first began, and certainly the Roman Catholic Church obviously first began under the Romans. And in the early centuries, the state authorities really tried their best to suppress the church and control it, because the supreme Roman value was law and order, peace and quiet, predictability in our cities, in our provinces, whatever. And in the early centuries, not few years, but several centuries of Christianity, there were violent fights among Christian leaders over things like the definition of the Trinity, the definition of salvation, even the definition of monotheism. Not to mention fights between Christians and Jews as the two religions slowly separated from each other. There were sort of Christian Jews and Jewish Christians and people pulling in both directions. And the Romans hated this. They hated public argument, disputatious, whatever, behavior.
Yeah, they didn't care what you believed in. They just didn't want any trouble.
Right. So the Romans tried in various ways and with varying degrees of intensity between the time of Jesus and the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. So for over 300 years, the Romans tried to eliminate Christianity altogether. They didn't, nor did they ever eliminate Judaism, but they did destroy the Second Temple, and they did destroy Jerusalem, and essentially kicked out most Jews from the land of Israel. All right, so to what effect? What happened to the Jews once they were kicked out of the land of Israel? I guess we'll have to talk about that next week.
We're working our way through this. Thanks so much, Tom. Chag Sameach.
And to you.
We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Yunbal Shtivi, the director of the Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Ol.
And Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach v'shana tova.
Shana tova, gemar tov, all those good things. We just completed Yom Kippur last week, and
yeah.
We have Sukkot coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Yom Kippur is a very special time in everywhere in Israel, but in Tel Aviv, explain like what a Chiloni experience, a secular experience of Yom Kippur. Like.
Wow. So, yeah. So Yom Kippur is, for the kids, it's bicycle day, actually.
Do they call it that?
No, it's just that the way that it's being practiced. Right. We all know it's Yom Kippur, but it is actually the day for those that are into bicycles.
Because you can bike in the middle of the street and there's no cars.
Yeah. There are literally no cars in the streets, on the highways. Everything is very, very quiet. It starts getting quiet at 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the Erev Yom Kippur, even 4 o'clock. And then gradually it becomes quieter and quieter and quieter until by sunset, there are simply no cars in the street. The traffic lights continue just because they're automatic, but they say nothing to no one because there are no traffic.
Nobody's paying attention. There's no traffic. Yes. Yeah. In Tel Aviv, which is one of the busiest traffic places, I think, in the whole world.
In the whole world, really. It's really busy and congested and so
noisy.
Yeah, noisy and so much, I don't know how to call it. The cars are polluting and it's very busy. So no horns or
no horns, that's right.
Yeah. No horns, no engines. Everything is very quiet, and then starts. And then, as families, we would all meet in one of the big squares as a community.
Kikar somewhere.
It's, some of the kikarot, and as a community, just go for a ride with our kids, and we can go very far in Yom Kippur because there are no traffic whatsoever. So, yeah.
It's what the world would be like if it was peaceful for more than just one day.
Oh. It was what would be like if cars were not outlawed from big cities.
Yeah.
Like they do in other, actually, in other cities around the world, some of the areas, yeah.
You know, Sukkot is coming up almost upon us tonight, and you were describing this very interesting architectural feature in some of the ultra-Orthodox buildings. Tell our two Jewish listeners about that.
Well, as we all know, the sukkah has very strict rules. In order to be a sukkah, to become a sukkah, it has to have a certain amount of walls. I think at least three.
Three temporary walls. Yeah. One permanent wall. The others are supposed to be temporary.
Yes.
Some people say two, but anyway, at least two. Probably
at least two. But one of the most important features is that you can actually see the sky beyond the schach.
Right.
You have to have schach.
Whatever plants or natural products you use on the roof to make the roof, you have to be able to see stars through it.
Exactly. So in the ultra-Orthodox, I was just seeing and reading about it, that and I actually saw it when I was in Jerusalem, that when they now construct for the ultra-Orthodox in Jerusalem and in other cities that are designed for the ultra-Orthodox lifestyle, which is quite unique and quite different from other lifestyles in Israel, they actually create the building in a way that will allow the sukkah to be built
on the balcony,
and it's so to be built and keep the rules of the sukkah to still be performed as a sukkah, even though it can be an 8 or 10 story building.
So it's just set back enough so that everybody's merpeset, everybody's balcony can see the
can
stars
see
when
the
they
stars,
build their sukkah.
And sometimes the balcony is situated to the right and sometimes to the left. So so no matter how low you are in the building.
Even if you're on the first floor, you can still build your sukkah and you can still
see the stars. So it's kind of to answer like the specific need
of the ultra-Orthodox
family.
Well, fascinating. Listen, Chag Sukkot Sameach, Zman Simchatenu, may it be a joyous season for you and your family.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Two Jewish as a public service. This week, the classic Sukkot joke. A guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York City. His landlord is irate and decides to sue him and asks the judge to force the tenant to remove the illegal structure. In court, the judge agrees with the landlord. I understand you have no permit for this unauthorized structure. That's true, Your Honor, says the Jewish guy, but it's a religious requirement. Well, that may very well be true, but this tabernacle structure of yours must go, declares Judge Feldman. I ordered you to remove it within 10 days. Next case. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Then there's the other classic Sukkot joke. How do you make an etrog shake? Put it in a blender with 2 scoops of ice cream. See, you're supposed to shake the lulav and etrog on this holiday. Well, maybe it's a lulav shake. Never mind. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy. Boker Tov and Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
So Sukkot begins tonight. It's the great harvest festival. And I would have always, and when I talked to people who lived on kibbutzim, there was always, they built a sukkah, they had a lot about the harvest. It was very agricultural oriented. You grew up in a moshav. A moshav is not a kibbutz. Tell us a little bit about the difference. And then, you know, did you guys do anything for Sukkot?
We haven't. We just, I don't know. I think every holiday is just an excuse for a big dinner and
big dinner with
to
family
see everyone.
And
yes. Yeah. So some of the people like make fun of the building a sukkah and building the decorations with the small kids. That's what my grandpa does with my young cousin. They're building a sukkah. And yes, that's like pretty much it.
So tell us a little bit about the difference between a moshav and a kibbutz. Both were so central to the formation of Israel, but they're a little different. Kibbutz, everybody owns
yes.
everything together, right?
Exactly.
Which means nobody owns anything.
Right.
What's a moshav like?
A moshav is like a bigger kibbutz. It's all really built on like partnership, but everyone's like for themselves. So if you earn money, it doesn't go for like a... partnered, like...
So if you go work at a high-tech firm and come back to the moshav...
The money goes to your own pocket.
You keep your own money.
Yes,
okay.
Not like
you
in
have
a
your
kibbutz.
Own car, for
yes,
example.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
You don't have to lend a car or sign up to get a car like it was in old days in a kibbutz. But it was still on, like, working together and working for the same goal and being, like, a whole family for
is
each other.
Is the land collectively owned? Where the moshav is, do you own your own plot?
No, everyone owns your own.
So you have your own stuff, but you kind of work together.
Yes.
So it's a cooperative society with a
exactly.
fair amount of...
Well, not that it's not that much anymore, but
yeah.
the general idea of it is... That
the concept was there.
Yes.
Okay. So Shai, Sukkot is a time off of school in Israel.
That's right.
You know, so whether you make a big religious thing about it or not, that's vacation.
Yeah, so telling you the truth, most of Sukkot, I've never been in... Most
in
of Sukkot, I went abroad with my family... And we actually never built a sukkah in our house. We went one time to our neighbor's sukkah, we ate a big meal, and that's it. So Sukkot is really fun for me because we're getting to get a trip in Europe or something. So it's really fun. Family quality time. Yeah, so that's Sukkot for me.
You know, I have to say, when I was living in Israel, Sukkot, we had... First couple of days, we built a sukkah on our merpeset in Jerusalem and lots of nice stuff, and that was all fun. And then I took a bus trip down and went scuba diving in Sinai for 4 or 5 days and came back for the end of Sukkot. So we were off of school, right? It's vacation. It's a beautiful time of year.
Right.
There's a good reason to be outdoors, whether you spend it in France or in Israel. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, is easy to overlook in the context of the fast flow of fall festivals. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are followed just 4 days later by the harvest holiday, whose principal observances seem based in an earlier age. The agricultural celebration of bringing in the fruits, vegetables, and grains to carry us through a barren winter. In today's world, where food comes from across the globe and virtually any kind of produce is available year-round, a particular week to celebrate reaping the rewards of the natural world might seem archaic. But the move in recent years towards seeking locally sourced produce and grains, produced using sustainable agricultural methods from native seeds, finding fruits, vegetables, and other natural products at farmers' markets and through growers' cooperatives, testifies to an understanding that what we produce from the ground nearby, with God's help, is the best food to eat and to serve to our children. There's nothing tastier than ripe, fresh vegetables and fruits, harvested recently at the proper time and season. They taste better and offer many health and environmental benefits as well, for us and for the planet. Perhaps that's just the way God intended us to live. For our ancestors in ancient Israel, Sukkot was considered the most important observance, Hechag, the holiday in the Mishnah, as though it were the only one. Of all the festivals, this is the one most often referred to in the Bible. It must have been the one on which more people came to Jerusalem than any other. Sukkot in ancient Jerusalem must have been an incredible scene. Sukkahs all over the city, songs and feasts for the full week. Today our focus on Sukkot is on thanksgiving to God for the bounty of the harvest. This season is known as Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy. Blessed with Torah readings that primarily focus on the rituals of this ancient festival, with some additional mystical passages. Here too the Torah reminds us that we exist solely through the grace of God. We offer thanks for the natural world that God created to help provide for our needs. That's a good reminder this week and always. Our guest this morning, Professor Dov Weiss, has explored just how we argue with God in Jewish tradition, and when that became acceptable and when it wasn't in history. Find out how he delineates this extraordinary process when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
On Yom Kippur this past week, a radicalized right-wing neo-Nazi from Eastern Germany attacked the synagogue in the town of Halle, Germany. He was dressed in army fatigues, wearing a helmet, and he had explosives with him and was carrying a shotgun. After shouting anti-Semitic slogans, he tried to break into the synagogue, but he was stopped by its reinforced armored door, which had been paid for by the Jewish agency. Frustrated, he then threw an explosive device into the Jewish cemetery and proceeded to shoot up a kebab restaurant, killing two people and wounding several others. After being alerted by panicked calls from the congregants in the locked-down synagogue, it took German police 10 minutes to get to the site and arrest the murderer. There were 50 worshippers in the synagogue at the time. The terrorist was seeking to inspire anti-Semitic attacks on other synagogues, and after failing to kill Jews, he decided instead to kill Muslims. Neo-Nazi and far-right anti-Semitism is on the rise in Germany. It's tied to anti-immigrant hatred across Europe and here in America, where there's been a similar rise. The German government has been accused of ignoring this resurgence of the movement at a time when anti-Semitic acts have increased significantly in Germany. Violent acts of anti-Semitism rose 80% there in the last year. It is not a small problem. Synagogues across the world are increasing security, hiring armed guards to protect worshippers and services. As we approach the Yart site, the one-year anniversary of the brutal attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, we must note that nothing has improved in this area. While much of the Jewish world has legitimately been focused on Islamist terrorism and anti-Israel and anti-Jewish activity on college campuses, the greater danger at the moment appears to come from radicalized terror from the far right, sick men who hang out on conspiracy theory websites that blame the Jews and the Muslims for everything wrong in the world and in their own sad lives. They find circular justification for their own hostilities and then export that hatred on the nearest Jews they find, especially if they are praying. It's a troubling beginning to this new Jewish year, particularly challenging that this took place on Yom Kippur. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu condemned Turkey's incursion into northeastern Syria this last week, vowing to assist the gallant Kurdish people. Israel strongly condemns Turkey's military invasion into Kurdish areas in Syria, Netanyahu said, adding that and it warns against the ethnic cleansing of the Kurds by Turkey and its proxies. According to Netanyahu, Israel is prepared to extend humanitarian assistance to the gallant Kurdish people. In response, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's communications director, Fahrettin Altun, tweeted, "Empty words of a disgraced politician looking at many years in prison on bribery, fraud, and breach of trust charges. The Syrian Kurds, including the 300,000 exiles in Turkey, are under Turkish protection. We will eliminate all terrorists in the area and help Syrians return home." The Turkish elimination of quote-unquote terrorists basically means their military is trying to slaughter all the Kurdish troops who were instrumental in defeating ISIS and have been U.S. allies for years. U.S. President Donald Trump defended his decision to pull U.S. troops out of the area in advance of the Turkish incursion. Trump tweeted, "Turkey has been planning to attack the Kurds for a long time, and I am trying to end the endless wars," all caps, talking to both sides. At the risk of stating the obvious, it is not clear how removing the 50 U.S. military advisors with the Kurds and giving Erdogan of Turkey a green light to attack a longtime U.S. ally that has been instrumental in defeating ISIS will end the quote-unquote endless wars in the region. In fact, at the moment, Turkey is starting a new war that seems to benefit the enemies of decency and democracy in the Middle East. Demonstrating his own ugly approach, Erdogan said Ankara will send the 3.6 million Syrian refugees in Turkey to Europe if European countries condemn Turkey's military invasion in Syria and call it an occupation. A top Syrian Kurdish official said Turkish attacks weaken the ability of security forces in northeast Syria to guard the prisons holding Islamic State ISIS detainees. Badran Jiakurd said that this may lead to the escape of jihadists. The number of prison guards is reduced as they fight against Turkey. And while ISIS was badly mauled by the coalition fighting against it, it is not yet dead, and this gives it the opportunity to come back in the area that the Kurds were controlling. It also needs to be said that one of the few ethnic entities that hasn't been able to have its own nation is the Kurds, who continue to be oppressed by all the powers in the region, Turks, of course, but also Iranians, Iraqis, Syrians, and even Russians. There are over 30 million Kurds, at least, in that region, perhaps as many as 40 million, who'd like to have their own nation, and frankly should. Instead, they get the short end of every stick. And, disappointingly, this time it's America that has abandoned them to a brutal Turkish dictator's slaughter. I suppose it's ridiculous to even note that President Trump said he was leaving them to the Turks because the Kurds hadn't helped the U.S. with the invasion of Normandy in World War II. No, really, he said that, or tweeted it anyway. The recent Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, has revived interest in Bruce Lee, the legendary kung fu film star of the 70s. Bruce Lee was of Eurasian descent. Most people assumed he was one quarter German. It has now been revealed that part of his ancestry was not German, but Jewish. Bruce Lee's great-grandfather was born in Rotterdam in the Netherlands and was Dutch-Jewish. The story is that his grandfather had a relationship with a British woman, and so Bruce Lee was one-quarter English, one-eighth Dutch-Jewish, and five-eighths Chinese. Sir Robert Ho Tung, the richest and most influential man in colonial Hong Kong, was his great-uncle. I'm not sure if that makes kung fu films more suitable for Jewish audiences. They are pretty campy to watch, but it's an odd tidbit nonetheless. In other news, the baseball playoffs coincided with Yom Kippur, and there has been a suggestion that there is now a curse of Sandy Koufax. The three teams with Jewish players who all played on Yom Kippur also all lost. The Dodgers' Jock Peterson, the Astros' Alex Bregman, and the Braves' Max Fried all played on Yom Kippur. All their teams were defeated. While Peterson played well and Bregman was fine, Fried wasn't good, but the message is larger since all three teams were favored to win and all lost. As a rabbi, I'm not positive this proves anything, and as a Dodgers fan, I'm still sitting Shiva for the best team in the National League, falling ignominiously in the divisional round after winning 106 games. But boy, all three teams lose while their Jewish stars played. Frankly, it's not a good sign for those of you who chose not to observe Yom Kippur. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, Dov Weiss, an associate professor of Jewish studies in the Department of Religion at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. He got his PhD at the University of Chicago, and his book, which is really just a fascinating exploration of irreverence in Judaism, pious irreverence confronting God in rabbinic Judaism, but not just in Judaism, won the National Jewish Book Award. We started to talk about the notion of God. You know, we talk about ourselves being created, B'Tselem Elohim, but then in the rabbinic conception, it's really God who somehow comes out, not that we're created in God's image, but God is sort of existing in our image, in your description. Can you explain about that dynamic a little bit?
Sure. So what I've noticed in the rabbinic tradition, particularly in the later rabbinic tradition, and here I'm referring to texts from like the 4th to the 8th century, texts mostly produced in Palestine or Babylonia, what I've noticed is that the later rabbis humanize God in ways that even go beyond the humanization of God in the Hebrew Bible, that God not only is imagined as having human-like form, but also human-like emotions and passions. And you know, we have that in the Hebrew Bible, but I think in late rabbinic literature it even goes further than that. And the rabbis imagine God as at times admitting that he makes moral misjudgments, and that he changes his methods of governing the world. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, in an evolutionary sense, you mentioned that in early rabbinic teaching, it moves away from this biblical dialectic in which people argue with God and disagree with God and take God to task. You know, Abraham's famous quotation, Hashafik kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, will the judge of the whole earth not act with justice? You know, that's a really powerful critique. But you say in the early rabbinic period, they move away from that until that questioning God becomes a kind of heresy, and then it moves back away. What do you think is at play in all of that?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is in the early rabbinic period, there were a number of Christians who believed that the God of the Old Testament was an evil God. The creator God, the God of the Hebrew Bible, is an evil God, and that Christ was, you know, the good God that was going to come and save humanity. These were people referred to as Gnostics or the position of Marcion.
The Marcionism, right.
The Marcionism, yeah. So the proto-Orthodox, what became the Orthodox Christian position, really had to defend the morality of the Old Testament God and of the Old Testament. And I think that the rabbis were affected by this internal Christian debate. And I think the rabbis were insistent, aligning themselves with the proto-Orthodox Christian view that God is morally perfect, and that any criticism of God might imply that God is not fully perfect, morally perfect. And the champion of this position is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, who lived in the second century of the Common Era and who supported the Bar Kokhba rebellion, he was adamant that no matter how much one suffers, one should never criticize God, because it's an act of disrespect, A, but B, because it implies that perhaps God made a mistake. And, you know, so I think the character of Rabbi Akiva is an important person here behind this more restrictive position that one shouldn't criticize God in the face of hardship. And that's something new, I think, within the Jewish tradition. And it became the position of the Christian church. But then I argue in late rabbinic literature, they started to move away from the Akivan position.
And just to bring it up to date in a little bit, you know, you still hear this argument, the Old Testament God is the God of wrath, the New Testament God is the God of love. But that turns out not to be the Orthodox Christian position, ultimately.
Right, right. The Orthodox Christian position is going to be that the God of the Old Testament is the same, you know, God as, you know, it's in their mind, the Father of the Logos, the Father of Christ. And that it's one, it's fundamentally one nature. This is one divinity in three persons, the God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. So yeah, the early Christians were involved in the same project as the rabbis, which was to defend the morality of God, even in the face of some biblical evidence that seems to point in the other direction.
That changes in the later rabbinic period. What real life changes take place? Is it just a evolution in Jewish thought?
Well, I think partly it's because the intra-Christian battles between the Proto-Orthodox and the Marcionites and the Gnostics are no longer being waged. I think the strong character, the position of Rabbi Akiva, I think waned over time. But I think there may be other factors at play here that may have played a role in the rabbis reviving, you know, the biblical position, which really embraced such an encounter with God, and that is a notion, a Greco-Roman notion called paresia. Paresia is actually a virtue. In the Greco-Roman world, paresia was understood to be a virtue. Paresia means that one should be honest with one's friend, that one shouldn't be a sycophant, that one shouldn't just, you know, lick up to a person, a friend, but even someone in authority. And as a matter of fact, the emperors, the Roman emperors typically hired a chief of staff who was not a person who was meant to be a yes person, but the emperors would hire someone whose job it would be to criticize the emperor. He was known as the Parisiastes. And in the 5th, 6th century, this chief of staff who was hired by the emperor to be his, you know, someone to direct him, was someone who was called upon to challenge the emperor. And this was a virtue. Yeah. It was a courageous position to assume in the Roman world.
Yeah, you would think so.
because you have to criticize, right? You have to criticize the emperor, but it's something the emperor wanted. It was a virtue. It was an exalted position. And in the 5th and 6th century, bishops actually, Catholic bishops assumed, many of them assumed the position of parisiastes. And I think part of what was happening in the late rabbinic period is the rabbis also wanted to see themselves as occupying this service of challenging the emperor, being the beloved person to honestly critique with courage. And they couldn't do so, obviously, in the real world because Jews had no power in Palestine. So my argument in the book is that they imagined the biblical heroes of old, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., as the figures who assumed the role of, you know, right-hand person of the King of Kings, who would critique God, and sometimes God would concede to the critique. There may be some other factors at play here. Sure. The notion of dialogues, of arguing, became, I think, a virtue within Babylonian culture.
Well, I mean,
Babylonian Talmud.
If you've ever read the Talmud, how can you not assume that arguing is central?
Exactly. So Babylonian culture became a culture where arguing was considered, you know, the apex of virtue, and everyone argues, and even God loves to argue.
But we have that as a stereotype today, right? Two Jews, three opinions, four rabbis, five synagogues, you know.
Exactly. And I think that really also lends itself to the theology which allows criticizing God. But there is still a position amongst traditional Jews. Many traditional Orthodox Jews still adopt the old Akiva position that criticizing God is deeply problematic. But I've tried to show in my book where this more permissive approach, really, when did it start and why did it start? And I think it ended in the medieval period for a while, but I think it was revived in the Hasidic period.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, the Kaddish of Levi Yitzchak Abradichev, the Abradichev of Kaddish, you know, challenging God and then finishing with belief, but still constantly challenging.
Exactly. And I think the larger argument of the book is that it says something about critique, that when we critique somebody else, one way of looking at critique is I'm finding fault, so I critique you. But another way of thinking about critique is that critique is really the height of love. It means that I care. You know, it means I care about you and I want you to be doing better. And I think any relationship where one side or one party is not allowed to be honest and one party is not allowed to critique the other, then there's something missing in that relationship. There's something wrong with that relationship, because to be in a relationship of love, we have to be able to be who we are and we have to be honest. Otherwise, you know, we're not sharing our deepest feelings, our deepest thoughts, and we harbor ill will. There's a beautiful teaching in the Midrash from Genesis Rabbah that says, "Kol ahava she'inimo tochacha ino ahava," which means any love that is not accompanied with rebuke is not true love. And in any loving relationship, and I've known this, you know, in my life through my family members, the closest people in my life, that part of the love is that we feel that we have the ability to criticize and the relationship is not going to be undermined because of the critique. But if the critique is done in a loving way, you know, but it still could be a strong critique, and the relationship will survive. And more than that, the relationship can even grow if we're open and we're honest. And I think on the high holidays, Jews around the world should feel free and be honest if they have a real relationship with God, to really, you know, let God have it if they feel that they've been wronged by God. You know, the permission to challenge, and God loves it. God wants it. God welcomes it, I would argue.
I want to thank Dov Weiss for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
So much for having me. It's been really, really an honor and a great zechut. Thank you.
My pleasure. The book is called Pious Irreverence: Confronting God in Rabbinic Judaism. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
The university. I teach at the University of Illinois. In the Department of Religion, so you can look up our website.
And get the book. It's just fascinating. Dov, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi, for having me.
My pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Andrea Simon, author of Floating in the Never Sink and the memoir Beshert, A Granddaughter's Holocaust Quest. Our playout this morning is the Hasidic Kaddish, often sung at the end of Yom Kippur last week, but appropriate to any joyous festival, like, you know, Sukkot. Join us for Sukkot at my own congregation, Beit Simcha, if you're in Tucson or Southern Arizona. It starts tonight with services at 6:30 p.m. at 7315 North Oracle Road, followed by a harvest potluck meal in our beautiful sukkah. Call 520-276-5675 or go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot, a Zman Simchatenu, a season of great joy, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Kayev kol beis Yisrael, pagalov kol mizman koyli. Ve'imru, 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 ve'imru
Islam, the Isnaser, the Isgalor, the Isgalev, the Isgalol.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.